Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the second hour of the program. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be dipping into the history of astrology. For thousands of years now, people all of the way from the ancient Near East to the modern world have believed that the stars shape the course of human affairs. Today, I think it's fair to say that if we polled most scientists, they would say that astrology was simply a fraud. Certainly, if we stopped into the astronomy department at their house not all that far from us here in Campbell Hall, I think that that would be the consensus of those people in astronomy. However, this morning, our guest, historian Benson Bobrick, will be arguing that astrology may well be the origin of science itself, at least in his new book, The Fated Sky, Astrology and History. He makes the argument that many other sciences, including mathematics and other disciplines, arose or developed in the service of astrology. His new book has just been out not too long. It's published by Simon & Schuster. In the book, let me just read to you a little bit, a couple of lines so that you'll get a sense of where it is that he is coming from. He writes, "This is not a book for or against astrology, but a book about its impact on history and on the history of ideas. That impact has been large, and without a competent knowledge of the subject, it's almost impossible to accurately trace or construe much of the history itself or the ideas that have governed its course." Our guest, Benson Bobrick, has authored a number of books on a range of very different subjects. You may recall that we discussed his book, Wide as the Waters, and I believe maybe I'd better just make sure I give you the right title. Yes, indeed. Wide as the Waters, The Story of the English Bible and the Revolution It Inspired, which was taking a look at the way that the English translation of the Bible developed, but he has also written on a number of other subjects. He's written about the American Revolution. He has written a book that is a history of stuttering and the various attempts that people have made to help stutterers. He's written a biography of Ivan the Terrible. He's written a history of the subway in history, myth, art, technology, and war. So his interests cover a fairly wide range. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Bobrick, hello.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, given that your interests have traveled over these very, very many different areas,
yes,
let me ask you why it is you became so interested in the history of astrology.
Well, it's a sacred science, not an empirical science. So the members of the astronomy department shouldn't be too exercised about it, actually, because it's a very different kind of system. Now, I became interested in it because I discovered in my own research that it had undergone a remarkable evolution over time, and that what we think of as astrology today was not at all what the system was that was practiced really down through the ages, almost up until modern times. In the history of ideas, astrology can certainly claim in honored place. And by astrology, I do not mean the sun sign astrology of modern times, which was more or less invented by a London salesman a century ago, but classical astrology, which won the allegiance of most of the great thinkers, at least up through the Renaissance. Modern astrology, in my view, deserves its disrepute. It's a mishmash, on the whole, of half-baked notions with no foundations in the learned path. But classical astrology, on the other hand, is the astrology of Plato, Ptolemy, St. Thomas Aquinas, of Girolamo Cardano, the mathematician who introduced the doctrine of cubic equations, of Shakespeare, and of Johannes Kepler, the greatest mathematical astronomer who ever lived, and it operates by very different principles and yields a wholly different result. Hmm. So, in short, in my inquiry into the history of the subject, I discovered that it was an extraordinarily rich one with a pervasive impact, as you indicated in your quote from the book earlier, on history and the history of ideas. So I felt that it might be useful to kind of reopen the discussion about it instead of simply declaring it a dead science or a pseudoscience or a superstition and so on, which some may hold for very good reason, but that doesn't really get you anywhere unless you know what it really is and what you're talking about when you say that.
Well, given the fact that, as you say, I think that today, if you use the word astrology,
yes,
what people will think of is indeed that little column that's probably carried in an awful lot of newspapers or magazines or whatever, and it is based on the sun signs. The idea is that you look up your sign according to the date of your birth, and then
right,
it gives you some sort of guidance or some sort of sense of expectations of what's ahead for you. Now, you're making the argument that, in fact, classical astrology has roots that go back a lot further and has a great heritage. But at the same time, I guess when I think about that, we're still talking about people's desire to have some heads up about what the future holds.
Yes.
And that you're still talking about people based on the date of a person's birth to try to say something about what that person's life was going to be like. There are people who were interested in trying to talk about the futures of regimes, rulers, potentates, cities. And that I am not exactly sure that I see the difference between that and the fact that some people would argue that it doesn't matter how skillful a scientist you are, that it's still based on the flawed assumption. I guess I'm not exactly sure I see the difference between classical astrology and what it is that now people think of as astrology.
Sure. Well, it depends what you would say the assumption is. Classical astrology, like modern astrology, looks at the pattern of the planets and stars as having meaning. And, of course, you know, we can go back to the first chapter of Genesis, where it said that the stars planets were created as signs, for signs as well as for seasons. So it has a sacred foundation. Modern astrology doesn't really have any clear rules for how you would interpret those signs, and it's, as I say, it's a mishmash of all kinds of things and largely sort of self-invented. Classical astrology had very rigorous rules for how you would interpret planetary positions and patterns, and that in itself makes it more interesting because it belongs to an august tradition. But I think it's more helpful to think of first of all, the difference between science, modern empirical science and astrology, as the difference between an approach to phenomena, natural phenomena, that looks for the rules that govern it, which is what empirical science does, and a sacred science which looks at what the meaning of that phenomena is. So it's a kind of religion in that sense. So there's no competition, really, or there shouldn't be, between science and astrology in that sense any more than there's any reason why ideas about evolution should be opposed to the idea that God created the universe. Evolution is a process within creation. There's no reason why they exclude each other, even though that argument goes on in the silliest way constantly, but people don't think of the ways in which they're really quite compatible. So what I would suggest is that that astrology is sort of the ancient form of DNA. It's a pattern. It shows a pattern in theory of a person's life that unfolds over time, just as DNA gives us the pattern, our genetic pattern, and our lives to some degree unfold according to its its pattern. And so it, in a way, it's a mirror of life in the same way that DNA is a mirror of life. And ancient astrologers understood it basically in those terms. So you could say that it really has a scientific aspect to it in that way. But I think that's a more enlightened way to understand it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is historian Benson Bobrick, and his most recent book is titled The Fated Sky, Astrology in History. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here who are ready to jump in.
Sure.
333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Starting with someone listening this morning in Indiana on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. I guess in a sense of popular culture, people wouldn't recognize the importance of astrology as being sort of the mother of a lot of things. I'm thinking of the 8 volumes by Lynn Thorndike, A History of Magic and Experimental Science, which was published by Columbia University
right.
Press. I think he pretty well established it. You know, basically that was a extension of his PhD thesis. Basically, he's set, you know, the record straight in a lot of ways, though, of course, they pick at him now, but the general picture is, yeah, that's true. In a sense, bring it to the popular culture is a nice thing. Just a little concerned about some of the things you've been saying, even if what you want to call this distinction, the classical astrology depended upon patterns of the moon, particularly in the sun, and some of the planets. You know, those things have all changed now. There's been a shift. And I wonder if you bring up in your book that, importantly, with modern astrology is when you want to say something's in Leo or something like that, that's not really what's happening physically. That's what was happening several thousands of years ago, you know, on the at Mesopotamia and places like that, when those things were started and the Greeks, you know, finally put the final frame to the whole thing.
Right.
I understand the aspect of having rational thought and having things leading to each other, but I don't think that's particular fundamental. Myths do that and things like that. So I think there's somehow your veneration of classical astrology, to my way of thinking, is a little misplaced, that, you know, still was a mistake. Even though people thought, quote-unquote, rationally, they weren't doing what we'd say science in any stretch of the imagination. It's not really a criticism, because it's nice to see books come about like this, because I think they're important for people growing up, because there's the horoscope pitches, you know, when your kids start reading the comics inside the newspapers. And it's just another thing that you have to burden yourself with when you get older. It'd be nicer if they had some understanding in the beginning so they wouldn't have to spend the time deburdening themselves and put their mind to something that'd be more productive. Thanks.
Sure. A couple of points. One, of course, you're talking about the precession of the equinoxes when you say that planets are in different signs now than they were a couple of thousand years ago. Actually, ancient astrologers understood precession. And for them, they weren't interested in the literal position of the stars, but the division of the sky into signs. So the zodiac always begins with 0 degrees Aries, and that's a fixed pattern. It's not a shifting pattern. There's a lot of misunderstanding about that. And so that really doesn't affect the way classical astrology works. There has been no change in the position of the planets with relation to the signs. There has been a change in the relation of the planets to the constellations, but the constellations never conformed exactly to the signs in the first place. And I do cover that and explain that in detail in my book. The other point that I'd like to make is that whether these ideas are fanciful and mythical, I think is probably for everyone to decide for themselves as they study it. It was striking to me, compelling to me in some ways, that Johannes Kepler, who was certainly a Copernican, understood everything that one could possibly know about astronomy. And, of course, we owe the laws of the elliptical planet, the elliptical orbits of the planets to him, since he discovered that. Was, in spite of that, a convinced and devout astrologer and devoted a great deal of his life to it. And if one can believe recorded history, and there's no doubt about this, successfully predicted all kinds of events by means of it, including the death of his own patron, Count Albrecht von Wallenstein, and the year of his own demise. Now, that might be coincidence. I'm not an astrologer, so I'm not competent, actually, to determine whether it was a coincidence or not. But it is striking to me that men of such immense intelligence and knowledge, both in science and the occult, as Kepler and Shakespeare, for example, who was clearly convinced by classical astrology and works it into his plays constantly, that gives me pause. Because I feel that out of sheer, humility, really, I ought not to just dismiss something as a superstition if it commanded the respect and conviction of people of such large intelligences as they. So I would just float that out there as something to think about a little bit without advocating it on either side, because actually my book takes a more or less neutral position. I was just interested in exploring it more objectively, and not, it would have been very easy for me to write a book that debunked astrology, and I'm sure every critic in the United States would have celebrated it for doing that. But I couldn't honestly do that because I thought that would falsify the nature of the history itself. So I went out on a limb and I tried to give it a fair hearing. And some critics have appreciated that very much, and some, have pounced upon me, as I expected, for somehow giving credibility to what they regard as a superstition and so on. That kind of misses the point of the book.
Mm. Well, maybe it would shed some more light on this to ask a question like this. If we know that we can go back to a time when there would have been when astrology would have been considered to be a science, or at least that it would not have been incompatible with science, and we have people who would have been considered to be verifiable scientists of their time. Why is it that at some point that science rejects astrology and it becomes pseudoscience? What happens for there to be this break between now what we would consider to be legitimate science, verifiable science, and astrology, which now, as we have said, some people certainly would consider to be pseudoscience? What happened to get astrology tossed out of the canon?
Well, what happened was that scientists, beginning with the 18th century, defined science, all science, as empirical science. And so any sacred science which gave was not only tried to ascertain the physical laws that govern phenomena, but gave any meaning to that phenomena, was excluded from consideration. In effect, the idea of God on which astrology is based went out of the world. That is, the idea of God as the creator of a universe in which everything is meaningfully linked. So that, for example, it's the great 17th century scientist Robert Boyle, the inventor of Boyle's Law of Gases and a dozen other things that that scientists revere today, but who was also convinced by astrology. He once remarked, if God created the planets and the stars just for us to know them, in other words, just for us to know what their orbits are and so forth and so on, he found that absurd. He thought that there had to be some sort of meaning to them beyond that, that they signified something, as Genesis implied, and as early classical tradition also assumed. So I think it's that. It had nothing to do with the fact that that Copernican astronomy displaced Ptolemaic astronomy, because actually Copernicus was interested in astrology, and his classic work was issued to the world by his closest friend, who was an astrologer. So the idea that somehow or other modern science displaced it is, again, an historical mistake that I discovered in my research. It really was that a different idea of God and the nature of phenomena displaced in older idea, but nothing was ever proved or disproved about it, and that's an important point.
Well, let's talk with someone else here, someone in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hello. It's 2 weeks past Epiphany, so you can imagine what my mind went to right away. And my question is, since in Christianity, one of our basic tenets of faith is that astrologers, the three wise men, had also foretold the birth of Christ. So I was wondering, when you did your historical research, did you find people like Thomas Aquinas had done research, or at least attempted to find the documents supposedly that these three men were studied to predict the birth of Christ?
Yes, actually, there's a chapter in my book, entire chapter about that. The three magi were, as we now know, astrologers, and most editions of the Bible have caught up with that truth, and they include it either in the text itself or in a footnote. The word magus referred to an elite Persian caste of astrologers, actually. And Aquinas accepted astrology, was astounded, actually, at how many predictions had proved true. His concern was that it might, he was interested in reconciling it with grace and free will, of course, and he decided that it was compatible with that doctrine. As for whether he sought out particular real or legendary documents which had bearing on the predictions of, or the foresight, foreknowledge of the Magi or not, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the Magi were working from any document in particular, but that the tradition at that time did foretell that there would be the birth of a savior, and they were looking for signs in the sky to confirm that. And so one might say that they, in fact, were prepared to see the telltale event, and therefore followed the star to the east. But it's a complex issue. I don't want to get into it in too much detail here, but there is a chapter on that subject in the book.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. Well, it does, though, underscore the idea that as far as the church was concerned, the Christian church, for some long period of time, had no problem with astrology.
Well, some of the church fathers did, and some didn't. They're really quite divided. St. Augustine had more of a problem with it than Aquinas did, but he acknowledged that astrologers were often accurate. He made the assumption, or the rather fearful assumption, I would say, that if they can be that accurate, they must have the assistance of demons to do it. Aquinas didn't go down that road. He felt that essentially that people were ruled by the stars if they were given to their bodily instincts and desires and their corporeal nature, whereas if they aligned their thoughts and understanding with something higher, then they could free themselves to some degree from the dictates of fate. And that was a theological argument that he made on behalf of of free will and grace.
Let me introduce again our guest, and then we'll get on to another caller. Benson Bobrick, he is the author of 8 previous books on various subjects, ranging from the American Revolution to the translation of the Bible into English. He has a doctorate in English and Comparative Literature from Columbia University. In 2002, he received the Literature Award of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He makes his home in Vermont. He's talking with us this morning by telephone about his most recent book. It's The Fated Sky. The subtitle of the book is Astrology in History, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go on to another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line 2. Hello.
Thank you. Does your book spend any time exploring Chinese astrology? And if not, why not, and how it might be similar or different from you know, I don't know if it's Western astrology, but just or the astrology that most of us in the West are familiar with, because I know that there at least there are differences in terms of signs and things like that.
Yes. No, I didn't. I allude to it, but Western astrology was such an enormous subject that I felt that to try and give an adequate account of Chinese or Indian astrology, for that matter, would just be too much to take on in this instance. Indian astrology, to some degree, actually derives from Greek astrology, and Chinese astrology itself is also connected with Western astrology by various currents of ideas. But that's a separate subject. And the short answer is, no, I didn't get into that.
Okay, well, I don't know if you're planning any future books, if you would explore that or not, but it sounds like it'd be an interesting exploration.
Oh, yes, it would be. I think it's beyond my competence. If I read Chinese, for example, and Sanskrit, that would be a great help to me. I do know Latin and Greek, and so I was able to explore Western astrology much more easily with confidence. But there would be something of a language barrier, and I'm not sure how many of the fundamental early Chinese and Indian astrological texts have been translated either, so that would probably be an obstacle.
Well, thank you.
All right. Other questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly we know that going back a very, very long way, people have been careful observers of the sky and have charted the movements of stars and planets and have no doubt felt that there was valuable information there and that there was some kind of connection between that movement and things that happened to them and things that happened on the earth. Having said that, what I'm interested in, particularly as far as classical astrology goes, is that what it was, that what people thought was the nature of the connection, and whether in fact they felt that these bodies, the planets, the sun, the moon, were actually exerting some influence on human affairs, or that the connection was a bit more abstract than that, and that somehow what happened here and what we can observe in the sky are connected to something larger than that, and it's not a matter of feeling that there is some sort of direct force, there's some sort of direct influence that comes from those bodies.
Yes, that's a very good question, because classical astrologers did not believe, as modern scientists often say that they believed, without really knowing the history, that, for example, the planets influence us in an astrological sense by gravity or by, you know, the intensity of their light and some sort of physical phenomenon that links us in that sense. Of course, we know that the moon's gravity has an effect on the tides and other other things, and there is a connection in that sense, a physical connection, but that's not the basis of classical theory. Classical theory can really be summed up really with that line in the Bible about the planets being and stars being in the heavens as signs as well as for seasons. They represent, in effect, ideas in the Platonic sense, or essences, and that every time Saturn moves or Venus moves or Mars moves into a sign or into some pattern with another planet and so on, it affects everything on Earth that is ruled by Saturn or Venus or Mars or the Moon and so on, a vast category of things that are ruled by each planet. So there's a simultaneity in what happens rather than there being a physical force which explains it. And that's the classical theory at its heart.
Hmm. I guess I'm having a hard time, though, understanding the difference between that and the idea that the planets, for example, are personifications of some sort of a deity mm-hmm. that has force and that exerts its influence on human life.
Well, I think you would find that classical astrologers looked at the myths of the gods as parables of what the planets are doing. In Homer, the different gods take the sides of the Greeks and the Trojans, for example, and the great Renaissance astrologer Girolamo Cardano is also one of the greatest mathematicians that ever lived, said, well, what do you think the ancient myths are doing here? They're really talking in parables about what the planets and stars are doing. And so he would have turned it around and said that the myths are myths about the actual meaning of the patterns of planets and stars.
Hmm.
If that clarifies it, I know it's elusive in a certain way, but that in any case would be how he explained it.
All right, let's talk with some others, people who are listening. Urbana, next, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
As you just said, meaning. Everybody seems to be looking for meanings, and so in astronomy or astrology, people look to the stars for some sort of meaning. Attaching deities' names to planets or what they call planets, since they really didn't know exactly what they were. But historically, I mean, do you think people are going to switch from that to like maybe trying to assign meaning to, DNA and how it expresses organisms and stuff like that? It seems to me like people spend an enormous amount of historical energy looking for meanings in everything. And as modern science would say, you know, like Dawkins is the blind watchmaker. There is no, purpose to evolution. There's just evolution. There's no, like, you know, it's not a hierarchical thing. It's not to... Evolution wasn't for, like, you know, the arguments about evolution now with the intelligent designers and things like that, that there's a purpose to all of this. Because a good example of the astrological part, or astronomical part, would be, you know, 65 million years ago, an asteroid struck the Yucatan Peninsula and wiped out 90% of everything, every living thing, let's say. Was there any meaning in that? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me like people are wanting to attach an anthropocentric meaning to all these natural phenomenon. When they discovered that there were supernovas, and like 125,000 years ago, by like in 1990, they detected the radiation from a supernova that happened 125,000 years ago. I mean, until then, they didn't even know it happened. But I mean, it just seems to me like that there seems to be a time lag here, where everybody's always looking around and seeing events that have transpired, or in trying to project it into the future. So I was just wondering if you had a comment on that.
Well, the difference I think that you're drawing here is between a secular mm-hmm. view of the world and a religious one. And if your point of view is religious, then there's no reason why any and everything couldn't have some kind of meaning to it. Of course, it's not in arbitrary. It shouldn't be an arbitrary meaning. And without going into supernovas and so on, mm-hmm. at least within the system of classical astrology, there are rigorous rules that govern the way you interpret astrological phenomena or planetary phenomena. So so I think it's, you know, it's very much just a difference in point of view, and some people will feel unconquerably that nothing really means anything, and that we're just an organism in an environment that's following its own indifferent course, and others will feel that we're actually a self with a soul in a world that was created by a somewhat inscrutable God, but that to some degree there's a way of at least understanding some of what he's up to and some of what the phenomena around us mean. So I think that's, you know, essentially the divide.
Well, yeah, but the divide would be, I mean, philosophically, religion is a philosophy more than anything else, based on the fact that most of the documentation from religion is probably 2,000 years old, maybe Islam 1,600. But the point is that I'm always telling people that, well, when you really read a religious document, these people didn't even know where they were. I mean, they assumed that the universe was everything that they saw, plus the sky and the, quote, planets and the stars, which they didn't even know were fusion, you know, fusion reactors. I mean, what I'm saying is that science has shown, I mean, how we came to science is an amazing argument there, but when you look at it in a reasonable sense, you realize you can delineate and say, well, like astrology was maybe a precursor to modern astronomy, as you said, Kepler and his mathematical genius brought the, you know, the elliptical orbits of planets into man's knowledge base and things like that. But, I mean, the farther away we get from all this sort of, like, as you might, you said, superstition, you have to look at it as like just sort of a form of ignorance.
Well, no, I think that, well, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, of course, we know more and more about the physical mm-hmm. properties of things, as you say, the way in which supernovas are formed and
mm-hmm.
and destroyed and fusion energy and all the rest of it. I'm not sure that changes essentially the meaning of what the object is that we understand. I mean, we understand its physical properties,
mm-hmm.
evolution, its physical destiny, and so forth and so on. But just as we now understand more about the bodily organism, how we eventually decay and die, it doesn't mean we don't have a soul.
Oh.
You see what I mean? So it doesn't change the nature of who we are. It does change the nature of what we understand about our physical self.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies writ large to the universe as a whole. So I don't think that one really eclipses the other in that sense necessarily.
So in a way, are you sort of saying observer contingent universe type of argument that we're sort of here to look at everything and we acknowledge it? I mean,
my own point of view.
Are you a deist in what I'm saying?
Right. No, my own point of view, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Is, and this, and as I say, I'm not an astrologer, but I do feel that when we bring a sense of awe and wonder mm-hmm. and reverence to nature, every aspect of nature, that we're somehow aligning that soul in us with something greater and something divine. I mean, I don't really want to talk about my personal.
I understand, but I get the gist. I just wanted to know where you were coming, but thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call. Very good. Let's go to line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Yes.
I would like to. I would like your speaker to talk about the assertion he made about the Hindu astrology is a derivation from Greek astrology. And that seems like a fairly Eurocentric point of view. And there are, in Hindu scriptures, there are instances where astrology and, I mean, they knew about astronomy. And actually, the contact with Greeks was in 300 BC, but Vedas and Mahabharata and Ramayana, there are a lot of astrological references there, and they were composed even before 300 BC.
Yes, no, I didn't...
challenge that assertion.
Right, no, I didn't mean to say that it was entirely derived from the Greeks, just that there were Greek influences at different points in the history of Indian astrology, and the great Arab astrologer Al-Biruni, who accompanied Mahmud Ghazni,
right,
early conqueror of northern India, wrote a wonderful book about Indian thought and Indian astrology, and he noted that some of the Indian astrological terms were actually transliterations of Greek terms, but he didn't. He also, as I recall, didn't say that Indian astrology was wholly derived from the Greeks. And I apologize if I seem to imply that. I just meant that there were influences that flowed back and forth between the Arab and Greek world and the
That is one possible explanation. That I mean, there's an intermixing of the ideas.
Yes.
That I mean, some went out of India and some came into India.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole, you know, thing just took place, I guess. So,
right, and there's a counter influence too. For example, we call Arabic numerals are really Indian numerals.
That's correct. Yeah.
Right, which the Arabs
from Leonardo di
yes.
Leonardo di Pisa.
Right.
Fibonacci, Count Fibonacci, right? I mean.
Yep.
Okay. Anyway. Thanks.
All right. Well, bye. Thanks for the call. We have maybe about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is historian Benson Bobrick, and his new book is The Fated Sky. It looks at the history of classical astrology. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It just, one of the things that strikes me, that, and I don't know if I'm understanding this right or hearing this right, though, that maybe what the kind of... contrast that we're setting up, or the kind of divide we're setting up between the way that we think about science now and the way that perhaps people thought about science, at least before the Enlightenment, has something to do with the attitude that we have now within science that says, given enough time, enough smart people thinking about something, doing experiments, making the best observations that we can, given enough time, we're going to be able to explain everything. And that somehow that perhaps if we look at science in its earliest times, they perhaps didn't take that attitude, didn't feel that, in fact, that everything could be explained, and that there were some things that somehow were a bit beyond explanation.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly we may eventually be able to explain everything in a physical or material sense. I don't think that science would pretend to or would even aspire to explain the soul, for example. That seems to me something outside its ken, because it would have to posit some miracle material. And scientists don't like to do that. I remember listening to a conference of various scientists who reacted quite adversely to the idea that there could be some sort of miracle material. And yet, all of us feel, I think, that we're more than just a physical organism. In fact, as Walker Percy, the great writer from New Orleans, a great religious writer too, once remarked, evolution can explain the brain, but it can't explain the mind. It can't explain consciousness. It can't explain the conversation that you and I, for example, are having right now. And no interactions of energy, no matter how many there are or how many fusions of force take place, are going to produce something wholly other, which is what the mind and consciousness is. So you know, man inhabits two different realms. It inhabits a physical realm, which science should and can and will explore to its utmost. And then there's that other realm, which is simply, I think, beyond its reach.
One of the things that I think that we know, you mentioned in your book, and certainly there is evidence from various surveys and opinion polls, is that significant numbers of people, something like 30% to 40% of Americans,
yep,
believe in astrology in this more, perhaps more, not so much in the classical sense, but in the more modern sense, in the sense that there are these forces that we can map by looking at the movement of things in the sky, and that will tell us something about who we are and what's likely to happen to us. And there has, it seems to me, all along in astrology, there has been this desire for a heads up, you know, to know something about who we are, where we're going, what's likely to happen to us, and to get a little bit of useful information that, you know, will prevent you from stepping into something that you'd rather not step into.
Sure.
Is that, do you think, that simple, that need for or that hope for understanding why things happen, and getting some, even if it's possible to get some heads up about what's likely to happen, that's just a very essential kind of human tendency, something that we want, something we're looking for, something we've all been looking for. And that explains why it is that yet today so many people are interested in astrology. And even people that, if you're going to take the point of view that says it's a fraud, you'd say, well, even people who you'd think were too smart, were smart enough to know better, would still somehow think that there might be something to it. I mean, why is that it continues to have some appeal and just hasn't let go of us?
Well, I think that goes very deep. And that is an ancient and age-old and still current idea to which all faiths subscribe, in Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and so forth, that God belongs to eternity and that all time belongs to a circle of eternity, so that everything that is past, present, and future belongs to the same circle or continuum. If that's true, then in some sense, one could, in theory, know the future, because you'd be able to touch some point of the circumference of that circle. Just as, for example, fate and God's foreknowledge are not incompatible with free will, because in theory, in Christian theory, God knows in advance all the free choices we are going to make. So all of everything that is going to happen has happened. And so astrology, in some occult way, but I don't mean occult pejoratively, assumes or acknowledges that and tries by its own methods to touch that circle of eternity in which all things are, in a sense, eternally present and everything is one. So I think really what you're talking about is something, a deep either instinct or knowledge or intuition or hope, perhaps, whatever it is, but that, I think, explains it ultimately.
So you're using, when you use the term occult, you're using it not in reference to the supernatural necessarily in the Gothic sense. It's more to the pure sense that something that is occult is just something that is hidden.
That's right. Exactly so.
There are a lot of things that we have not talked about, and I think that are really interesting here, and that is the impact of astrology on not only on science, but also on art, architecture, literature. Is there anything that here now, as we come down to about the last minute or so, sort of stands out in your mind as a lovely example of that?
Well, I would begin with the general notion that most of the sciences, in fact, science itself really begins with astrology, since people were not interested in the stars and the planets originally they weren't trying to calculate their precise orbits. They were interested in what their positions might mean, and from their study of the movements of the meaning, what they understood to be the meaningful movements of the planets and stars, they began to calculate periodic revolutions and the times of their orbits and so on, and from that derived methods of timekeeping. In the same way, all plants and animals were thought to be ruled by different stars and planets, and so from that came the interest in botany and zoology and so on. All the sciences, to some degree, derive from astrology, because astrology was thought to govern everything on Earth.
Well, at that, I think that we will stop. We must, in any case, because we've come to the end of the time. The book that we've been talking about is The Fated Sky, Astrology and History. It's published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest, Benson Bobrick. It's out now in the bookstores now if you want to look at it. You might also look for some of his other books, and he's written on a wide range of subjects, as I said, and everything from the history of the American Revolution to the history of the translation of the Bible into English, and I'm sure that you could find those books in the bookstore or in the library. And Mr. Bobrick, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this very much.